The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It's impossible to understand the destruction and slaughter that Vladimir Putin is unleashing in Ukraine without understanding his most basic conviction, that the breakup of the Soviet Empire was a catastrophe that Russia has yet to recover from. No one I know understands this history more intimately than Stephen Kotkin. Kotkin is a professor of history and international affairs at Princeton University, and he's a research scholar at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He's written two volumes so far on the life of Stalin, with one more to come, as well as books on the Soviet Union in its last years. We've been hearing from voices both from the past and the present telling us that the reason for what has happened is, as George Kennan said, the great blunder of eastward expansion of NATO. A modern realist historian like John Mearsheimer tells us that a great deal of the blame for what we're witnessing now must go to the United States. So I thought we'd begin by your analysis of that argument.
I have only the greatest respect for George Kennan, whom I knew. John Mearsheimer is a giant of a scholar. But I respectfully disagree. The problem with their argument is that it assumes that had NATO not expanded, Russia wouldn't be exactly the same or very likely close to what it is today. What we have today in Russia is not some kind of deviation from a historical pattern. Way before NATO existed in the 19th century, Russia looked like this. It had an autocrat, it had repression, it had militarism, it had suspicion of foreigners in the West. This is a Russia we know, and it's not a Russia that arrived yesterday or arrived in the 1990s. It's not a response to actions of the West. There are internal processes in Russia that account for where we are today. I would even go farther. I would say that NATO expansion has put us in a better place to deal with this historical pattern in Russia that we're seeing again today. George Kennan was the greatest Russia expert who ever lived, but I just don't think blaming the West is the right analysis for where we are today.
When you talk about the internal dynamics of Russia historically, it reminds me of a piece that you wrote and was published in Foreign Affairs 6 years ago, and it began like this. For half a millennium, Russian foreign policy has been characterized by soaring ambitions that have exceeded the country's capabilities. Beginning with the reign of Ivan the Terrible in the 16th century, Russia managed to expand at an average rate of 50 square miles per day for hundreds of years, eventually covering one-sixth of the Earth's landmass. And you go on to describe three fleeting moments of remarkable Russian ascendancy during Peter the Great, and then Alexander I's victory over Napoleon, and then, of course, Stalin's victory over Adolf Hitler. And then say, these high water marks aside, Russia has almost always been a relatively weak great power. So if you could expand on that and talk about how the internal dynamics of Russia have gone on to describe it both historically and in the present day under Putin. That would be, I think, very helpful.
So with Russia, what you've got is a remarkable civilization. You know it. You know it in the arts, in music, in literature, in dance, in film, in science. It's just a deep, profound, remarkable place. A whole civilization, more than just a country. Its problem has always been not that sense of self, not that sense of identity, but the fact that it's in a struggle to live up to this aspiration that it has for itself, which it can't because the West has always been more powerful. Russia's a great power, but not the great power, except for those few moments in history that you just enumerated. And so in trying to match the West, or at least manage the differential between Russia and the West, they resort to coercion. They use a very heavy state-centric approach to try to beat the country forward and upwards. And that works for a time, ostensibly, very superficially it works. And Russia has a spurt of economic growth and it builds up its military. And then, of course, it hits a wall. It then has a period, a long period of stagnation where the problem gets worse. The worst part of this dynamic in Russian history is the conflation of the Russian state with some personal ruler. So instead of getting the strong state that they want to manage the Gulf with the West, they instead get a personalist regime. They get a dictatorship, which usually becomes a despotism. So Putin is what he is. He's ruling in Russia, and he's got these circumstances, almost a syndrome where geopolitics is trying to make up for a power differential that it can't make up for.
Well, let's describe Putin and Putinism. What kind of regime is it? It's not exactly the same as Stalinism. It's not certainly not the same as Xi Jinping or the regime in Iran. What are its special characteristics, and why would those special characteristics lead it to want to invade, or why would Putin want to invade Ukraine, which seems, at least from this distance, singularly stupid?
Yes, well, war usually is a miscalculation. It's based upon assumptions that don't pan out, things that you believe to be true or wanted to be true. But let's back up for a second. So, of course, this isn't the same regime as Stalin. Of course, there's been tremendous change. The shock is that so much has changed, and yet we're seeing this pattern that they can't really escape from, where you have an autocrat or even now a despot making decisions completely by himself. Does he get input from others? Perhaps. Do they bring him information he doesn't want to hear? That seems unlikely. Does he think he knows better than everybody else? That seems highly likely. So he believed, it seems, that Ukraine was not a real country. He believed that the Ukrainian people were not a real people, that they were one people with the Russians. He believed that the Ukrainian government was a pushover. He believed what he was likely told or wanted to believe about his own military, that it had been modernized to the point where it could organize not a military invasion, but a lightning coup to take Kiev in 1, 2, 4, 5 days and either install a puppet government or force the current government and president to sign some paperwork. One other example we might allude to is what happened in Afghanistan in 1979. Very, very similar situation in some ways. The Soviet Union did not invade Afghanistan. It did a coup in Afghanistan. It sent special forces into the capital of Kabul. It murdered the Afghan leadership, and it installed a puppet, Babrak Karmal. But of course, they decided they might need some security in Afghanistan for the new regime. And so they sent in all sorts of regiments, army regiments, to provide security. And they ended up with an insurgency against their rule, and they ended up with a 10-year war that they lost. And so we have here the assumption that it could be a successful version of that, and it wasn't. And it turned out the Ukrainian people are brave, and they're willing to resist and die for their country. And it turned out that the television president, Zelensky, who had a 25% approval rating before the war, which was fully deserved because he couldn't govern, now he has a 91% approval rating. But the biggest surprise, of course, was the West. All the nonsense about how the West is decadent, the West is over, the West is in decline, it's a multipolar world, the rise of China, etc., etc. All of that turned out to be bunk. The courage of the Ukrainian people and the bravery and smarts of the Ukrainian government and its president Zelensky galvanized the West to remember who it was.
Let's discuss the nature of the regime, because it seems to me that the Putin regime changed somewhat. What actually is the nature of the regime and the people who are loyal to it and the people who are important in it?
So it's a military police dictatorship. It, in addition, has a brilliant coterie of people who run macroeconomics. And so, for example, your central bank, your finance ministry are all on the highest professional level. And that's why Russia had this fortress, this macroeconomic fortress, these foreign currency reserves, the rainy day fund, reasonable inflation. For the macroeconomic stability, for the economic growth, you sort of need decent relations with the West. But for the military security part of the regime, which is the dominant part, the West is your enemy. The West is trying to undermine you. It's trying to overthrow your regime in some type of so-called color revolution. And so what happens, the balance of those groups shifted more in favor of the military security, let's call it the thuggish part of the regime. And of course, that's where Putin himself comes from. And so the regime became more and more corrupt, less and less sophisticated, less and less trustworthy, less and less popular. It hollowed out. But that's what happens with dictatorships. Once again, they hollow themselves out.
But such a regime, it seems to me, would care above all about wealth, about the high life, about power. Why would they care about Ukraine?
It's not clear that they do. We're talking about one person here. So this is the thing about authoritarian regimes. They're terrible at everything. They can't feed their people. They can't provide security for their people. They can't educate their people. But they only have to be good at one thing to survive, the suppression of alternatives. If they can force all opposition into exile or prison, they can survive no matter how incompetent, no matter how corrupt, no matter how terrible they are. If money just gushes out of the ground in the form of hydrocarbons or diamonds or other minerals, the oppressors can emancipate themselves from the oppressed. The oppressors can say, we don't need you. We don't need your taxes. We don't need you to vote. We don't rely on you for anything because we have oil and gas, palladium and titanium, and fill in the blank, all the minerals that they have that they extract, which is all just cash flow.
Now, the West has decided, for obvious reasons, not only not to go to war with Russia, but not to have a no-fly zone, for all the reasons we know. And the greatest exertion it showed is in economic sanctions, which in fact have proved to be more comprehensive and more powerful than maybe people had anticipated some weeks ago. But in the scheme that you're sketching out, it seems to me that at least for a good while, the people these are most aimed at will be able to absorb sanctions. Or do you think I'm wrong?
So yes, the financial sanctions are very impressive, but they'll take a while to affect the calculus of those people around Putin and Putin himself. The biggest sanctions and the most important sanctions are always technology transfer. right? It's always starving them of the high tech. So if you deny them over time through the Commerce Department, American-made software and American-made equipment and products, you can hurt this regime and create a technology desert. And the Chinese cannot come in and substitute because they need that same technology that we're denying to the Russians.
Yeah, but in the meantime, as we saw in Grozny in 99-2000, as we saw in Aleppo, Russia is perfectly willing, if precision doesn't work, they're perfectly happy to use decimation. And that is what we're seeing in Kharkiv. We've seen it in other parts of Ukraine. And to my mind, it's only just begun, potentially.
Russia has a lot of weapons that they haven't used yet. But there are a couple of factors here. First of all, Ukraine is winning this war only on Twitter. On the battlefield, they're not winning this war. Russia is advancing very well. What's failed was the attempt to take Kiev in a lightning advance. But otherwise, their war is unfolding well. Moreover, the largest and most important consideration is that Russia cannot successfully occupy Ukraine. They do not have the scale of forces. They do not have the number of administrators, and they do not have the cooperation of the population. They don't even have a Quisling yet. You know, we're waiting for Viktor Yanukovych to reappear. Viktor Yanukovych was the duly elected president in 2010 in free and fair elections, who was unbelievably corrupt and was chased out of power by protests, and he fled to Russia, and Yanukovych is still in Russia. But let's think about him. He's a psychologically unimpressive character. He was incompetent. Could he actually have the willpower? Would he even agree to run Ukraine on behalf of Russia? And if not him, who else? And moreover, think about all those Ukrainians who would continue to resist. And if you're an administrator or a military officer in occupied Ukraine, and you order a cup of tea, you're going to drink that cup of tea? You want to turn the ignition on in your car? You're going to turn that ignition on? You're going to turn the light switch on in your office? And all it takes is a handful of them being assassinated to unsettle the whole occupation.
Finally, you've been very quick to give credit where credit is due to the Biden administration for reading out its intelligence about the coming invasion, for sanctions, and for a kind of mature response to what's happening. What, if anything, have they gotten wrong in this?
They've done much better than we anticipated based upon what we saw in Afghanistan withdrawal, in the AUKUS rollout, the rollout of the deal to sell nuclear submarines to the Australians. But they've learned from their mistakes. That's the thing about the United States and the West. We have corrective mechanisms. We have a political system that punishes mistakes. We have strong institutions. We have powerful and free media. And so administrations that perform badly can learn and get better, which is not the case in Russia. And it's an advantage we can't forget. The problem now, David, is not that the Biden administration made mistakes. It's that it's really hard to figure out how to de-escalate. We keep raising the stakes with more and more sanctions and cancellations because that's where the pressure is on our side to, quote, do something because the Ukrainians are dying on television every day. But the more you corner, the more there's nothing to lose for Putin, the more he can raise the stakes. We need a de-escalation from the maximalist spiral, and we need a little bit of luck and fortune here, perhaps in Moscow, perhaps in Helsinki or Jerusalem, perhaps in Beijing, but certainly in Kiev.
Steve Kotkin, I'm very grateful to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen Kotkin is a professor of history and international affairs at Princeton University. This was an edited version of my conversation with him, and you can read much more and also watch the video at newyorker.com. And for more context on the invasion of Ukraine, you might want to hear my conversation with reporters Masha Gessen and Joshua Yaffa, who shed light on everything that they've seen on the ground. That's on a recent episode of our podcast. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Jane Campion's film, The Power of the Dog, opens like a classic Western. This cattle being herded across the sweeping plains, imposing mountains in the distance, we're on a ranch in Montana.
25 years since our first run together. 1900 and nothing.
That's a long time.
Not too damn long.
So the plot of the film isn't exactly a Western. It's an intense drama about two brothers. Brothers who share the business, but seem to be opposites in almost every way. It chronicles what happens when one of those brothers marries and brings his wife and her teenage son to the family home. Jane Campion is a true auteur with a highly personal style, dreamlike, but often brutal. She's found mainstream success telling very idiosyncratic stories. The Power of the Dog is nominated for 12 Oscars, the most of any film this year, including Best Picture and Best Director. Jane?
Yes, hi, David.
I spoke with Jane Campion last week. Well, this film is adapted from a novel from 1967 by Thomas Savage. Why did this one hit home to you? You must go through stacks and stacks of novels.
Yeah. All
kinds of source material that might make up a film, and you don't...
It's a brilliant novel. I mean, it's a forgotten, unloved, uncherished book, but I think it's just actually quite brilliant, and you also feel the truth in it. You know, like, this is almost something between a memoir and a fiction, you know, that the way he writes is so detailed and particular that you know he's lived it. You know, it's his lived experience, and it feels like something you can totally trust.
One of the things I assume you have to deal with is you're not only adapting from a particular novel, you're also either up against or aware of a whole tradition of Western movies in the history of American filmmaking.
Yeah.
And how did you view your film against all those many, many, many either genre pictures or John Ford pictures or that whole long and complicated tradition?
Well, I don't understand the whole of the long, complicated tradition, but it is a very romantic genre that all of us, everybody, me included, have fantasies about. What I felt my allegiance to was Thomas Savage's particular story. You know, here I had someone who really did grow up in the West, who was irritated by the romance of the West and found it to be not showing the best of men sometimes, but the worst of them.
Mm.
So he wrote a very particular tale. It's not trying to say, oh, this is the West, but it is a counterpoint, I think, and, you know, and a subversive one to the dominant, I suppose, fairy tale of it, you know?
Now, last week, the actor Sam Elliott, who's played a hell of a lot of cowboys in a lot of Hollywood movies, went on a podcast, yeah. Marc Maron's podcast, and Maron asked him what he thought about Power of the Dog. And Elliott really slammed the movie. He asked what a woman, a person from New Zealand, knows about making Westerns, why you'd shoot in New Zealand, and in general criticized your portrayal of cowboy life.
Yeah.
Do you have any response to that? Do you care?
I love Sam Elliott. He's he's a wonderful actor. And, you know, I understand that from his point of view of playing classical cowboys and feeling like in some way he and his cohorts own that genre, it must be disturbing. But, you know, I have to point out that there were women in the West as well. They weren't all whores or whatever else. And, you know, there were plenty of women that were watching and had very different points of view about how things were happening. And also that Sam, I don't know how old he is, but I'm sure he wasn't there and around in 1925, and he sure as hell wasn't living on the ranch that Thomas Savage was living on or in his skin. And so I think it's, you know, that problem of, you know, a certain generation of men having problems accepting other people's points of view.
Now, your films are not always, but usually centered around female leads. I don't know what the arithmetic is there, but it's more often than not. Here, this is not the case, although obviously Kirsten Dunst has a big role in this.
Yes.
Was that a particular interest in pursuing a more male-oriented story, or it was just by the by?
It was a kind of casualty of just falling in love with this book. I mean, it wasn't lost on me either. Like, oh, my God, here we are, my first male lead, and what a guy, you know. So and I thought about it a little bit because, you know, I think being one of the few female directors out there for some time, I did used to feel very strongly that I needed to keep telling stories about women that meant something to me. But I think with the advent of Me Too movement, that, you know, things have really changed, and they have, you know, really changed for the better. You know, for a very long time there was an extraordinary lack of equality for women in our industry, and their systemic abuse, you know, didn't feel like an urgent problem or even a problem. And that change, I feel it extremely, and I think it's emboldening a lot of women to do whatever they want to do. And, you know, I think there's a kind of fearless urgency that is producing some really interesting work from women that came about because of, you know, their support by both, you know, men and women. And, you know, and that sort of shift, that dynamic shift in the industry, which is a bit like the Berlin Wall coming down.
And it's that market. You feel it.
The statistics are so stark. They tell the story anyway, but to tell it in a human way, is this is how I would recount it as someone who lived through it, you know, who's been in the industry for 40 years, that the inequality was noted, but it wasn't urgent, you know?
Yeah, you had experience with Harvey Weinstein about which The New Yorker and The New York Times did a lot of reporting.
Yes.
And you worked with him pretty closely on the piano. And were you...
Well, I didn't work closely with him on the piano. No, he bought it when it was finished.
So did you have much contact with him?
Well, I mean, I live in Australia and New Zealand, and he lives in New York. I did work on Holy Smoke with him, and it was a pretty horrendous experience.
How so?
Because he didn't like the story, which is really not surprising when you think about it. And you think about what Holy Smoke was about, which is young girl taking on a man who, you know, fancies himself as a cult breaker, and but has a crush on the girl, and the girl doesn't like him, and, you know, fancies that she's going to teach him a bit of what it feels like to be a woman treated in that way. Mm. Anyway, he really hated the film, and, you know, maybe, I don't know if it was because the film was actually bad or not. I think probably it's okay. But he wanted me to change it, and, you know, he really just screamed down the telephone at me, almost like a shark attack.
A shark attack.
And I can just remember saying to him, Harvey, why are you speaking like this? This is so uncivil, you know. You can't talk to people like that. It's horrible.
That turned out to be the least of it, almost.
Well, yeah, I never actually suffered any sexual abuse from Harvey at all. He wasn't interested in me in that way. But I just didn't know it was so systemic, you know, like it was happening to so many people.
Yeah. Jen, I want to play a clip from the film. Your films often center around characters that have some quality that makes them, let's just say, hard to love. And Phil Burbank is certainly that. And he and some of the other farmhands are sitting down to dinner, and they're being served by a young man named Peter, played by Cody Smith McPhee. And we'll hear Phil making fun of the way Peter is holding a napkin.
Now, gentlemen, look, see, that's what you do with the cloth.
It's really just for wine drips.
Oh, you got that, boys. Only for the drip. Now get us some food.
And the thing is, as the film progresses, you find some empathy in him. He changes somewhat. Where did you draw from in imagining Phil's character, or is it all there in the novel written out for you?
I think it's an alchemy between what was imagined and written by Thomas Savage and who Benedict is as an actor and a man in his interpretation. I think Benedict can really open up in an extraordinarily beautiful way to his emotions that, if he wasn't able to do that, would it be a very different portrait. But I think he brings us into the sort of dark, treacly, disturbed heart of Phil, you know, which is, so lonely and vulnerable and yearning for a full life he can never lead because of who he is.
He sounds like, Benedict Cumberbatch sounds like an incredibly intense artist, and you have formed over time very intense relationships with various leading
you say
actors.
Intense like it's a scary thing.
Well, I gather that he is very much of in the modern sense a method actor. What was the reality of that?
Benedict is everything. He's very funny, and he's very personable, and he's very affectionate and warm-hearted. But, and you know, like, because he and I agreed, and I asked him to stay in character on this set because it's such a long way from who he is, and it helped all of us to know that Phil was on set, you know, and so that if he, you know, he would argue with me sort of as Phil, you know, and about what we were going to do, and he likes, I think, Ben to have a dialogue that goes on, like he's got a, you know, a monologue in his head that goes on, and then it becomes verbal, you know. He verbalizes it and he starts to talk about the options, this, that, and he really is thinking of every possible, you know, variation that you could do on any scene. And at a certain point, you know, like I accompany him in this because it seems like something that is his process. And then after a while, I go, oh, let's just do it, eh? You know.
So even when he's having lunch or talking with you about various parts of the film and the cameras are not rolling, he's in character. He's not the kind of posh Englishman that we kind of know from red
exactly,
carpet interviews.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't have lunch together, but we had many social events together. But yeah, no one said he was Phil, and it really gave him, you know, that beautiful space to just not have to be the nice actor guy, you know, celebrity that everybody wants a picture taken with. And he, you know, that one of the requests that I had during rehearsal was that he every day said no and never said thank you, you know, for as many things as possible. So he just lost all responsibility to politeness, which he said actually was a great freedom. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, you've had an astonishing career and you continue to make just amazing work. You've had big hits, you've won big awards, revered by your peers, and you haven't had to make a Marvel movie yet. I wonder if it feels that way to you. What's missing from the picture I just painted of your career? What have been the real obstacles and downsides?
I am, you know, like a loner and also a really sociable person. So I really love working with colleagues and having fun. I mean, you know, my idea about life is like, you know, the best thing you can possibly do is laugh, you know, and I just love laughing. I love people make me laugh. So the big hole is comedy. I would it would be really fun to be a comic or a comedian or make films that make everybody laugh and be able to sit there in the cinema and just hear people really have some belly laughs, you know. I mean, I'd love to just be there while Ab Fab and all that lot do their stuff or the Bridesmaids crew, you know. I'd do anything just to be on those sets, you know. Because as I say, you know, I think that, you know, there's nothing more wonderful than laughing.
Jane Campion, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, David.
Jane Campion is the director and screenwriter of The Power of the Dog. It's been nominated for 12 Academy Awards, and that ceremony, of course, takes place on March 27th. And next week, we'll present one of the most important rituals in cinema. We'll give out the coveted awards known as the Brodies, recognizing the most visionary films of the year, according to The New Yorker's Richard Brody. I hope you'll join us. There's more to come on The New Yorker Radio Hour today, so stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Staff writer Jonathan Blitzer recently profiled Caetano Veloso, the great Brazilian musician, although, as John writes, the phrase great musician doesn't really cut it. Veloso is a Brazilian national treasure. He's one of its finest songwriters. He was also a political prisoner and then an exile. He's a voice of the 60s who, at the age of 79, is as active in making new music as he ever was. Here's Jonathan Blitzer.
The first time I became aware of Caetano Veloso, I was in my early 20s. I was living in New York. and I wandered into a movie theater somewhere uptown for an evening showing of a film by the great Spanish director, Pedro Almodóvar, and the movie was called Talk to Her, Hable con Ella. And I went into the movie not knowing specifically what to expect beyond the fact that this is a director I loved, and I just kind of wanted to bliss out and watch this movie. There is a scene right next to a pool in this villa somewhere in Spain, and there's a group of people who have assembled to listen to musicians sing.
Dicen que por las noches no más se le...
That's Caetano Veloso. He appears in this scene. And he's sitting on a chair in front of a microphone, kind of gazing out into the distance, and is singing this song. It's called Cucurucucu Paloma. This is a Mexican folk song from the 1950s. He has this liquid melodic tenor that also just drifts so effortlessly into falsetto. And I can't remember how I began to piece together, you know, who this man was, why I needed to hear more of him. But it became an obsession.
John, I had the honor of attending your wedding to our colleague Alexandra Schwartz, in fact, and you guys walked down the aisle to one of Caetano Veloso's songs.
We chose Oração ao Tempo, a prayer to time. It's an older song, but there's a more recent version we especially liked.
És senhor tão bonito quanto a cara do meu filho.
And a lot of people at that wedding came up to us afterwards and said, like, who is that?
Vou te fazer pedido. Tempo, 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 tempo. Compositor de destinos. Tambor de todos.
Now, pop music stars usually don't sustain a career for forever and ever. I mean, they have a moment in time, and if they're lucky and if strike some chord, they're there, and then things fade. But Caetano Veloso is hardly a new artist. He's released about 50 albums. He's composed music for several singers and musicians over the years, including his sister. What was it like being with him, and why has he been able to sustain that popularity and creative fervor for so long?
I mean, he is constantly reinventing himself and his music to a degree that is honestly voracious. A friend of his, David Byrne, was telling me that that's the thing he actually admires most about Caetano and is intimidated by, even the fact that every album is new, every composition goes in a new direction. He is just, you know, kind of constantly hungering after new musical sounds and experiences. And to hang out with him, you kind of even get a little glimmer of a sense of it, because you're just seeing what he's reading, what he's listening to. It's in every direction. It's classical music, it's pop music, it's hip hop. It's, I mean, everything. Nothing is too low or too high for him. He just kind of consumes it all and then somehow weaves together this concoction that is just his.
Now, you've been tasked with choosing just four songs from Caetano's enormous body of work. What do you have
torture
for us?
It was.
What do you have for us first here?
Well, I was moving chronologically, and I thought I would start with a song called Corazao Vagabundo, or Wandering Heart. And it's one of the first songs he ever wrote. He wrote it when he was 21 years old.
Meu coração não se cansa de ter esperança de dia ser.
It's written in this kind of bossa nova style. He released it and immediately said that, okay, this is an end of a chapter for me. I'm already going to be moving in a different direction after this song. But this is a song he's always loved. His collaborators have always loved. It's just a song that persists through time as a classic.
Vagabundo quer guardar o mundo. eventually, Caetano develops what's known as Tropicalia music, a kind of movement. What is that?
That movement is, you know, about bringing in international rock forms and fusing them with traditional Brazilian music, sambas and kind of old classics. And at that time, there were street protests in Brazil, in the middle of a military dictatorship, in which leftists protested the rise of the electric guitar in Brazilian music. I mean, this was, you know, hard-fought territory, and Caetano kind of blew right through it and started incorporating rock sounds from, you know, English neo-rock, as he called it, and American, you know, Hendrix stuff and the Beatles, and kind of fusing it all together. It was a total sensation, and it lasted a few years, and it basically landed Caetano in prison.
Now, I think I can pronounce your next selection. It's called 9 out of 10. Tell us about that song.
So this is a song that Caetano wrote while he was living in exile in London. So he spent 2 years in political exile from the dictatorship. And I've always loved this song because there is a moment in his time in London when he's really struggling with depression. Here he is in exile. His life has been upended. And this song in particular, to me, you can... it captures this battle that he's fighting, where he really chooses life. There's a line where he says, you know, I'm walking down the road, I'm hearing reggae music, I'm alive, alive, alive. He keeps repeating it. Then he drifts into Portuguese and says, in Portuguese, he says, there's the sound of music rumbling in my belly.
Walk down Portobello Road to the sound of reggae. I'm alive. The age of gold, that's the age of old. Age of gold, the age of music's past. Hear them talk as I walk, as I hear them talk. I hear they say, expect the final blast. Walk down Portobello Road to the sound of reggae. I'm alive e vivo, muito vivo, vivo, vivo. Feel the sound of music banging in my belly, 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 belly.
I just feel like it's a very personal song, and I know that he's always been particularly proud of this album. It's from an album called Tranza, which he started in England and then ended up finishing in Brazil after returning a few years later.
Now, he returned, as I understand it, at the suggestion of his hero and sometime collaborator, João Gilberto, the great pioneer of bossa nova.
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, Caetano once said to me, I didn't believe in God, but I believe in João Gilberto. And he received a call one day in the early 1970s, while he's living in London, from João Gilberto. And Gilberto says to him, Caetano, you have to come home. Now is the time. And of course, this is not a man who's particularly well known for his practical acumen or his political understanding of what's going on in Brazil at the time, Gilberto. And so Caetano understandably says, how do you know it's safe? And he and his wife at the time then set out to try to figure out whether or not they can return. And, you know, will they immediately be imprisoned again? What will happen? They kind of can't get any firm answers. They decide to roll the dice. And then when they touch down, it all happens exactly as Gilberto says it would. He's welcomed, no problems at the airport. He's able to kind of ease back into his old life.
Now, what is the next song, your third song?
The third song is a beautiful one called Terra. And this is a song that Caetano wrote 10 years after his time in prison. So it came out in the late 1970s. The lyrics refer to a specific moment when he was in prison, when his then wife comes to him with a magazine that had photographs taken by astronauts of the Earth from outer space. And it was this incredibly poignant experience for him, because here he was wasting away in this tiny jail cell, and he's seeing some of the first photographs of the Earth from space.
Quando eu me encontrava preso na cela de uma cadeia, foi que eu vi pela primeira vez as tais fotografias em que apareces inteira, porém lá não estavas nua.
John, help us out with the lyrics here.
He's describing sitting in a jail cell when he sees these photographs of Earth taken from outer space. And he points out that Earth isn't naked because she's wearing the clouds around her.
te esqueceria. Ninguém supõe a morena dentro da estrela azulada, na vertigem do cinema. Mando um abraço pra ti, pequenina, como se eu fosse.
Your fourth song, your final and favorite track, maybe. What is it? And is it in the same mode as Terra?
Well, I picked it in part because it sounds completely different. It sounds like it's from an entirely different artist, which is the sensation you get listening to Caetano. This song is called The 13th of May, which is the day that slavery was abolished in Brazil in 1888. Caetano is from Bahia, which was a kind of major hub of the Brazilian slave trade. And it's also, not unrelatedly, the home of samba, which is an Afro-Brazilian musical form, which is kind of at the core of a lot of Brazilian popular music and definitely at the core of Caetano's music. And so this is a song about the day that slavery was abolished, and it's set specifically in the town where Caetano grew up, Santo Amaro.
And this is on an album from 2000.
This is on an album from 2000 called Knights of the North. And the album, the entire album is dedicated to Afro-Brazilian percussion from Brazil's Northeast.
Dia 13 de maio em Santo Amaro, na Praça do Mercado, os pretos celebravam, talvez hoje ainda o façam, o fim da escravidão, da escravidão, o fim da escravidão, o fim da escravidão, da escravidão.
Now, John, you write that Caetano originally wanted to make movies, but he ended up making music because of the political persecution he experienced long ago. He is now 79. Has he expressed any regrets about the creative life he could have had? Is he a happy guy?
You know, I have to say, he said to me many times that, you know, he fell into music, he was interested in other art forms. I mean, I believe him. I take him at his word, but I'm somewhat skeptical because it's hard for me to imagine him doing anything else. You know, one thing that his friend Gilberto Gil told me is the reason Caetano says things like that is because he can do all of it, and he just chose music. But he could have been a painter. He could have been a writer. He could have been a filmmaker. It's hard for me. I mean, I can't imagine Caetano doing anything but making music like this.
You can read Jonathan Blitzer's profile of Caetano Veloso at NewYorker.com. Veloso's most recent album is Meu Coco. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for joining us.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Harrison Keithline, and Mengfei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botin. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.